Hi everyone, welcome back to the show. It's Louisa Nicola. I'm a neurophysiologist and human performance coach. I'm the founder of NeuroAthletics, where our mission is to democratize brain health education so you can perform better, think faster, and live longer. Today I'm doing a mashup of two guests who are going to give you a crash course on blood work. You know, most of us get a standard panel of blood tests when we go to our yearly physical. Glucose, cholesterol, and you probably assume that if any particular result is too high or too low, the doctor will let you know. Therefore, you're pretty much saying that no news is good news. Maybe you get something that's a bit out of range, you Google the number, and you look at the standard ranges, and you see, well, what does that actually mean? This is not the path to an optimized life. There is so much scaremongering around biomarkers such as LDL cholesterol, because LDL cholesterol on its own doesn't actually tell us that much unless it's at a very, very high level. What matters more is what types of LDL particles we have, specifically the ratio of small, dense LDL particles. These are the problem-causing ones, to the big fluffy ones. So since the test for that is hard to get, you can get a sense of it from your triglyceride to HDL ratio. Now, this is just one particular thing that we're going to touch on today. One thing that I really, really hate is that there is a lot of noise, especially on social media. Even when you go to your regular doctor, maybe they won't even give you an ApoB. Maybe they won't check the LP little a for you. And they don't really go into too much detail for an optimized range of what you should be looking for in your blood work. Guys, blood work is a really beautiful thing. You can really lift the hood and figure out what is happening in your body. However, it takes a really qualified person. I'm not talking about your general practitioner. I'm talking about someone who can really sit down and analyze your data, analyze your blood work, and not give you reference ranges based on population norms, which is what you pretty much have when you go to the doctor. You want reference ranges that are much better than the population norm. You want high performance reference ranges. So I put together this episode, which is going to look at almost everything, ALT, AST. You're going to be looking at hydration. You're going to understand what is vitamin D. You know, most of the US population is deficient in vitamin D. And so a lot of people are just supplementing with 5,000 IUs of vitamin D when you probably don't really understand what vitamin D is, how it's synthesized, how it's produced, what lowers it, what do we have in our body in the presence of vitamin D that is maybe increasing it. So you're going to learn all of that today. I hope you enjoy this mashup. If you do, please let me know. If you haven't smashed the subscribe button, please go and do so. Also, really good news, these episodes are now on the YouTube website. So we now have a YouTube channel, guys. Just type it in, the Neuro Experience, or find Louisa Nicola on YouTube. Subscribe to that as well. I hope you have an awesome day and I hope you enjoy this mashup. We'll get to the mashup in just a second, but I want to talk to you about Bubs Naturals. This is the collagen that I have been taking every day. Yes, if you think that I look 22, it's probably because of the collagen. No, I joke. But I started taking collagen peptides when I read a human study that showed that supplementing with collagen significantly reduced wrinkles around the eyes after only 12 weeks of treatment. So collagen is quite a ropey structure. It keeps everything together, and the breakdown of collagen from the environment and UV rays damage the skin. So therefore, we age quicker. And as someone who's deeply invested in maintaining optimal health, the one thing that I really love is getting clean products, and that's what Bubs Naturals is. So Bubs Naturals collagen peptides and their MCT oil creamer enhance not just my overall well-being and my skin health, but also my nutrition. So their collagen is sourced from grass-fed and pasture-raised cows. It's the purest form, which obviously promotes joint health, gut health, muscle recovery, and skin health. So if you want simplicity, if you want clean products, if you want better aging skin, go through, check out Bubs Naturals, especially if you're a woman, because this really means a lot to me. Both having simplicity, flavorless collagen peptides that I can add to my smoothie or my coffee means, you know, the absolute world to me and my productivity. So if you want to get this, go to bubsnaturals.com. You'll get 20% off. Enter code NEURO, N-E-U-R-O, at checkout, and you can get your hands on the MCT oil creamer and the Bubs Naturals. So that's bubsnaturals.com, code NEURO for 20% off.
In America right now, only 6.8% of people are considered to have optimal good energy, good metabolic health. The way you can know simply and easily if you have it is to look at five key biomarkers. The first is fasting glucose. You want it to be under 100 milligrams per deciliter. The next is triglycerides. This needs to be under 150 milligrams per deciliter. The third is HDL cholesterol. You want this to be above 40 milligrams per deciliter in men and above 50 milligrams per deciliter in women. The fourth is waist circumference. We want this to be less than 35 inches in women and less than 40 inches in men. And the fifth is blood pressure. This should be under 130 over 85. Now, these are what are considered normal. And if you are a person that meets all five of those biomarker criteria off medications, you're part of that 6.8%. Unfortunately, I have to say that looking at the research, we actually want our biomarkers to be in a tighter range than that. We want our fasting glucose to be between 70 and 85. We want our triglycerides to actually be less than 100, not just less than 150. We want our HDL to be probably between 60 and 90 rather than just above 40 for men, above 50 for women. So these are the basic criteria we want for knowing if we have good energy, but even tighter is better. And if we can all focus on those biomarkers, we can definitely make that 6.8% bigger, which is critical if we're going to reverse the chronic disease epidemic in the United States. LDL is what's often referred to as quote unquote bad cholesterol. HDL is sometimes referred to as quote unquote good cholesterol. The reason that we think of as HDL as good cholesterol is because it takes cholesterol from the body back to the liver to be processed and excreted. LDL kind of gets a bad rap as bad cholesterol. What we really want to understand is actually what types of LDL cholesterol we have in our body and what ratio. There are at least two types of LDL, small density LDL and high density LDL. It's the small density LDL that is most dangerous for the body. These are like little BB gun pellets that can go around the body and lodge in the blood vessels and promote the process of blockages and atherosclerosis. So what's really interesting is that it's insulin resistance. It is high sugar diets. It is high blood sugar and that metabolic dysfunction that pushes our LDL towards small density LDL. And that's the number we really, really want to decrease. So what's really important is not only understanding just what your total LDL number is, but actually asking your doctor to order advanced lipid testing, the fractionated forms of our cholesterol, so we can see what types of LDL we have and know if we have more of the dangerous types. And the best way to reduce that more dangerous LDL, the small density LDL, is to reduce our refined sugar and our refined grain content from our diet, reduce our insulin levels, get our fasting glucose down. That's going to go hand in hand with decreasing the dangerous amount of small density LDL in our bodies.
In the book, you've also mentioned hsCRP and uric acid. What are these two and what are the best, most optimal values?
So uric acid is a fascinating molecule in the body that does not get enough airtime. Uric acid is the byproduct of fructose metabolism and of purine-rich food breakdown. And so purine-rich foods are things like animal foods like red meat, seafood, organ meats, and also alcohol, especially beer. But this is not to say that people should not be eating animal protein. The main driver of the high uric acid in our bodies as Americans today is the fructose. It's the liquid fructose that was invented in the 1970s and now which is in almost every product in our grocery stores on the shelves. We really need to focus on the fructose to bring down the uric acid. So uric acid is generated when fructose is broken down in the cell, and it goes on to cause mitochondrial dysfunction and to generate chronic inflammation in the body. It also, because it's a, it can form a crystalline structure, it can crystallize in our joints, and that is what causes gout. So no surprise, people who have gout have a much higher risk of metabolic diseases and chronic inflammatory diseases, because these all are part of the same spectrum of disease that is rooted in high uric acid levels and then goes back to fructose consumption. So we really want to ask our doctors to check our uric acid levels. You're probably going to get pushback because the doctor's going to say, you don't have gout. You don't need, exactly. You don't need to get your uric acid checked. What you're going to do when that happens is give them one of two books. What you're going to do in that situation is give your doctor one of three books: my book, Good Energy, which describes why uric acid is important, or Drop Acid by David Perlmutter, or Nature Wants Us to Be Fat by Rick Johnson, all of which talk about uric acid. The range is considered to be quote unquote normal by standard criteria is usually around 1.5 to 6 milligrams per deciliter for women and 2.5 to 6 milligrams per deciliter for men. However, the optimal range, which we know has a lower association with metabolic disease risk, is actually less than 5 milligrams per deciliter for men and between 2 and 4 milligrams per deciliter for women. So women shoot for 2 to 4, men less than 5, and everyone get rid of the liquid fructose from your diet. So hsCRP is a wonderful biomarker for understanding the baseline chronic inflammation levels in our body. And like we talked about, chronic inflammation is one of the three hallmarks of bad energy, of metabolic dysfunction. Unfortunately, the standard ranges for hsCRP say that less than 3 is essentially normal. In reality, many studies show that less than 0.3 is what we want to shoot for optimal inflammation levels in the body. So this is one that you really want to be targeting to get as low as possible. Because remember, anytime you have chronic inflammation in the body, it means that your body is revving up a warlike response to some threat, and that is diverting energy from putting your biologic resources towards thriving and instead putting them towards fighting something. The main things that we're fighting in our culture right now are our ultra-processed diets, our chronic low-grade stress, our sedentary behavior, our lack of sleep, and all the environmental toxins that are in our food, water, air, and personal care products, and the fact that we are seeing artificial light at night. All of those things trigger chronic inflammation. So if your CRP is high, you need to take stock of those things in your life and you need to work to improve them. We want to shoot for less than 0.3 milligrams per deciliter.
Triglycerides is another one, right? We're just talking lipid panel. There's just less than 100. So I can have zero. I can have no blood. I can have no fat at all in my blood. Like, that's not important for anything. Mm. But that's a giant flag. It's actually been demonstrated that less than 50 in triglycerides is associated with cardiovascular risk, and less than 40 is associated with autoimmune risk. But then the reference range is just have less than 100. So this is something that is a major problem, especially if that person, say, has gut issues too. If somebody has a very low level of triglyceride uptake, or rather triglycerides in the blood, that can be a sign of a malfunctioning gallbladder. Your gallbladder's job, or one of its jobs rather, is to create bile and flow that into the duodenum of the small intestine. Bile emulsifies fats into fatty acids so we can properly uptake them into the lymphatic system and then ultimately into the cardiovascular system. But if we lack bile flow, and bile duct issues are common problems, how people get gallstones. Mm-hmm. If we lack bile flow, then we will lack emulsification of fats, which means the fats will not be taken up in the lymphatic system and then the cardiovascular system, and then we'll have progressively, quote, great triglyceride levels as they over time begin to get lower and lower. And then you have this weird pain on the right side of your abdomen. You don't know where that came from. And it's because you have gallstones.
Yeah.
These things, they're very preventable, and they're very, on first glance, if it's already low, that's an action step for me, is to inquire further, because you could order a stool test at that point and look at fecal fats. If fecal fats are high, then we know that fat digestion and assimilation is not taking place. So then we know that it is a bile flow issue. It's markers creating a type of situation to where me as the detective, I'm like, huh, so actually what's happening here is X, Y, and Z, and you're able to begin formulating a protocol to really help this person moving forward. So like that's an example to where you can look at something as simple as a lipid panel, but then draw that out into gut health and then continue to draw that out into other areas of health, because you're now talking about fat utilization in the body, and that would be precursors for hormones that would be used for the synthesis of many different things. So we'll move on from that. So that is just one example. HDL is another good example. Like HDL, like I mentioned, it just says greater than 39. Okay. But in men, it has, and this has multiple times been demonstrated, there is a U-shaped risk pattern, just like I'm glad I talked about it in the beginning of the podcast, because for men, HDL, once it starts climbing above 75, risk factors actually begin to go back up. Now, women get away with it from a little longer. Their risk factors tend to go up around 90 or so on the end of that risk curve, but you don't flag for it. So then I always turn to think, it's like one of the best questions I ever asked myself when looking at labs in my career is, I wonder why my body thought that was a good idea. Because that's like, if you can ask that, if you can look at a marker and go, wonder why my body thought that was a good idea. That's like the best question you could ever ask to actually get to the root cause problem of what's taking place. Because your body, from a million years of evolution, is infinitely smarter than you. It was smarter than you 10 times out of 10. So when you see a marker is kind of trending high, that is an adaptation to allostasis. It is adapting to the current allotment of stressors that life has placed upon you. And biomarkers are either going up or down for a specific reason. You got to start questioning, okay, like what else is HDL involved in? Besides just the management of LDL, okay, well, it's also involved in glucose management. It's also actually been connected to neutralizing lipopolysaccharides, which are inflammatory gut bacteria. So then you could, okay, you can start, is this being connected? What are the glucose markers looking like on the rest of the lab? Or does this person have any gut symptoms that could possibly be connected to lipopolysaccharides? These are just more things that you can draw out. So those are two things that are like, say, from the common sense world. But then you start talking ratios as well, too, like the LDL to HDL ratio that should be calculated independent of what their absolute values are. Non-HDL cholesterol simply being total cholesterol subtract HDL, giving you an output of non-HDL cholesterol to see what kind of load that has on your cardiovascular system. Lipoprotein little a, this is something that the reference range is usually from 0 to 75. But you're in a higher risk, it is considered optimal to be less than 18. So these are all many things that as you can see, you and I could probably talk Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 about this kind of stuff. But there's so much more than meets the eye. And just probably the greatest point of value that I could provide there is why did the body think that was a good idea? If you can ask that question, that you are on your way to a real answer.
Yeah, that's actually interesting for vitamin D. I'm going to get to that in a moment, but I just want to stick to LDL. Let's say I'm going to change my reading and say I got 110. Now, the American Heart Association, correct me if I'm wrong, says they want an LDL less than 99. Is that correct? Yeah, less than 100?
That is correct. Yep.
Great.
Yep.
Many people walking around with maybe, let's say, 100 or even 110, and they think, and maybe they're even in their 30s, which is, you know, scary because it's trending as well, as you said. What's the biggest reason as to why someone has a high LDL? Is it simply, okay, you're eating too much saturated fat, that's it?
So it could be a variety of things, right? In my experience, just working with my kind of populations, that people who have the higher LDL are generally due to poor diet and poor body composition. Kind of like the standard things that you would expect. If somebody has a poor diet or if somebody has poor body composition, those are the biggest things that are going to lead to suboptimal LDL. But then you do consider, you know, what is that ratio? An ideal ratio of LDL to HDL is 2 to 1. So if somebody has a 120 LDL, but then they still have a 60 HDL, that actually puts them in the ratio perspective to where the HDL is at a point in unison with the LDL, even though the LDL is classically considered too high. There are many people who would argue that LDL should actually be around 160 in terms of something that would be considered a more accurate risk factor, and that 99 is incredibly conservative in the world of cholesterol. As we've learned more and more and more about it, there's a lot of people that would bump that LDL up, especially if it's in ratio and in unison with HDL. But for the most part, what I've seen in populations striving for performance, body composition and poor diets raise LDL, whereas drug use is what lowers HDL. Let's talk about vitamin D for a second, because okay. This is another fascinating one where many things can pull it up and many things can pull it down. So let's just have a nasal breath and bring our pissed offness down just for a quick moment. Okay. And we'll talk about vitamin D. So vitamin D, you mentioned lead, okay? So vitamin D is a lot of people don't know. It's also involved in heavy metal retention. So it helps us absorb metals. So when in the presence of lead, it's been demonstrated that our body will auto-regulate to lower vitamin D as a protective mechanism to not uptake more lead. So in the presence of lead, our body forcefully lowers vitamin D as a protective mechanism. So then when it's like, I should take 5,000 IU. That didn't work. I should take 10,000 IU. That thought process alone is just ridiculous to me. Mm. It's like, better bump it up. It's like, yeah. You're taking 10,000 IU. Something else is going on, sir. So that's one thing, right? So that can impact vitamin D. Vitamin D, though, it's also a negative acute phase reactant. Like this one is, the literature is out there. This is the paper I pulled up called Vitamin D, a Negative Acute Phase Reactant. Okay. Let me just read this sentence from the conclusion. Serum vitamin D is a negative acute phase reactant, which has implications for acute chronic inflammatory diseases. Serum vitamin D is an unreliable biomarker of vitamin D status after acute inflammatory insult. Vitamin D is an unreliable biomarker of vitamin D after acute inflammatory insult. So it is a negative acute phase reactant. So this is something that reduces in the presence of inflammation. It reduces in the presence of lead. It's been demonstrated that it increases in the presence of boron. Okay. Glutathione. Glutathione plays a big role in vitamin D metabolism. Mm-hmm. And this has been demonstrated as well, that in people who have low vitamin D, if you give them NAC, which is a precursor to glutathione, mm-hmm. if you give them NAC and not vitamin D, vitamin D increases due to improved glutathione metabolism. So glutathione actually enhances vitamin D in the absence of additional vitamin D supplementation. It's been demonstrated as well that butyrate and one's gut health can improve the conversion of inactive vitamin D 25 serum, which is what we measure, into active 125 vitamin D, which also a lot of people don't measure. They just get inactive 25 and then act like that is the active 125 when it's actually not. They're just looking at essentially a vitamin D reserve as opposed to the currently active vitamin D in the body. But that conversion, yeah. a butyrate within the gut plays a big role in that. Air pollution and bisphenol A, so different types of environmental pollutants, they've been demonstrated to suppress vitamin D. So then you think, it's like, well, I live in California, one of the sunniest states in the United States. I am in the sun all the time and I eat healthy. But am I surrounded by air pollution? I probably am. I'm around millions of people constantly. Mm. Could that suppress vitamin D? Probably could. Could I also just have some form of inflammation? Could I have possibly have a Fleming system that is connected to some form of lead? Do I have any kind of glutathione issues at the moment? Magnesium, for the exact same purpose, it's involved in vitamin D metabolism. And again, magnesium supplementation in the absence of vitamin D has been demonstrated to increase vitamin D. So like this is just me riffing here. That was like 6, 7, 8 things that can either pull vitamin D up or pull it down. It's not a stagnant marker. You're not looking at something and then just making a recipe book decision on whether you need more or less of it, because physiology is a portrait. Everything is connected to everything. That's like you learn that the hard way when you read 1,000 labs and then you make 1,000 mistakes, is that everything is connected to everything, and you find new ways in which the body has checks and balances in physiology. And then again, I wonder why my body thought that was a good idea. I took 10,000 IU of vitamin D and it didn't move. Should I take 20,000 and force something that my body clearly doesn't want to happen? Or should I read some papers? You know, my moving forward now, I start reading literature at that point. I'm like, hey, something else is going on here that I haven't learned yet.
Going back to what you said about the uptake of vitamin D, how it's suppressed, just say you do have lead in your system, okay? And then vitamin D is low because it doesn't want to reuptake that lead. What would happen then if you then were substituting and taking 10,000 IUs per day? That means it would just increase your lead, right?
And reduce your health. Yeah, you're working against your body rather than with your body. You're forcing something that your body does not want to happen.
So this must make you, okay, so you know a million times or 10 million times more than what I do when it comes to this. And I already get mad now around social media, how people are just saying, oh my gosh, I got a low vitamin D. Social media must get you mad if it gets me mad.
It gets me furious. Yeah, yeah, it does. And my face goes red really easy. So I'm just red faced at my computer, just a full tomato head. Just why is this on social media? It is the worst. Creating absolutist statements is absolutely insane to me in social media. And even creating like these 30-second clips, because even I've been clipped on things that I wouldn't necessarily agree with myself, because it's in isolation with no context. I'm like, man, why'd you create that clip? Because now everyone's going to think that I'm some absolutist idiot. But it is crazy to me that people think you can do blood work part-time. You can't. Blood work is not something that can be done part-time. See a freaking specialist. Because I'll add to my statement, because I said previously that the value is not in the lab, the value is in the interpretation. Not only is the value in the interpretation, the danger is also in the interpretation.
Oh, yeah.
You might actually be screwing it up, okay? If you don't know what an adaptation is and what levers you need to pull and what you actually need to stay away from, then you shouldn't be interpreting your own blood.
Brings up another point. How many times have you heard the word chronic fatigue?
So like that could be a lack of iron, because you will absolutely have fatigue in the presence of suboptimal iron. Candida, an actual fungal overgrowth, one of their primary symptoms is fatigue. So if you are somebody who struggles with yeast issues, or if you are somebody who has an actual fungal growth problem that is currently going undetected and you've got lots of gastrointestinal symptoms, the hallmark symptom of that is fatigue. You can have purely just a bad diet. I think that has to be in there as well. I think that there's also people that you don't properly utilize low-hanging fruit, like deloads, like active recovery periods. They don't actually periodize training. They kind of just exercise, as opposed to have a periodic and phasic approach to their training that manages fatigue before fatigue even becomes fatigue. That's something that is outside in, but is something that you can certainly hang your hat on. Also, from a fatigue perspective, like low testosterone, and I can't emphasize enough, testosterone is typically always seen as very male, but it is absolutely female, just as estrogen is male. We both use these hormones for many, many, many reasons, but they're just deemed these certain things for no reason. We both have them in our physiology for a reason, and they can both lead to fatigue issues. So those are all things that can lead to fatigue. But then you also have kind of like backdoor stuff. Like if you have a thyroid problem, thyroid is going to regulate energy metabolism. So if you have a lack of T4 to T3 conversion in the liver, then you can run into fatigue through the back door, because it's kind of like a double back door, because like you first think that you just have a caffeine deficiency, and then when that doesn't work to overcome your fatigue and you go from 200 to 300 to 400, you might have lower thyroid or increased TSH on your panel, and you might think it's very thyroid focused, but then you start reading and you learn about the thyroid liver connection, so it becomes kind of like a double back door thing. So that can hold back fatigue. You can have low DHEA. Many people associate DHEA with its protective factors, because it's like DHEA, like if I may take a moment to be an even bigger nerd than I already am. DHEA.
Please do, because
like
I also had low DHEA.
Oh, it's my favorite hormone. It's my favorite one.
Well, I was going to go into hormones after this. Yeah.
DHEA is one of my favorite hormones because it's so under discussed. DHEA is our resiliency factor to cortisol. Like when you see hormonal panels or hormone metabolism branched out in textbooks, you're going to see that everything comes from this thing called pregnenolone, which is like the mother of all sex hormones, because you need it to make anything. If you want to make estrogens, if you want to make DHEA, if you want to make testosterone, androstenedione, progesterone, cortisol, they all come from pregnenolone, even aldosterone, which regulates our electrolytes. This is all coming from pregnenolone. And then if due to evolutionary biology, in the presence of stress, we will be prioritizing the formation of cortisol in the absence of DHEA, because cortisol is seen as a survival hormone. This is something that is there for the purpose of fight or flight. It's there to deal with stress issues. It's there to deal with problems. And it's very excitatory for that reason. So it's something that can impact sleep, which also can impact fatigue in the long run. But the more and more we prefer this cortisol pathway, the less and less DHEA we make. And then we progressively reduce something called DHEA sulfate over time. So you can measure free DHEA in your saliva, which is free, readily available DHEA, ready to rock and roll and bind to any receptor you need to have its beneficial effect. But then you also have DHEA sulfate, which is like the reserve of DHEA in the body. You can think about it like a tank of DHEA in the body that your body's going to use on an as-needed basis. It's basically going to grab this DHEA sulfate. It's going to shoot it over to the liver so the liver can do a cool thing called sulfation, which removes the sulfate molecule from the DHEA, and ta-da, you've got your free DHEA. But your cortisol, and this is like super, super valuable for people to know, the cortisol to DHEA sulfate ratio, this is serum blood cortisol to serum DHEA sulfate, should be between 0 and 0.09. That's what that ratio should be, between 0 and 0.09. Now, it sounds like a weird ratio, but those are absolutely the numbers. When you start to exceed, once you start to get to 0.1, 0.11, 0.12, once this begins to exceed and you have more cortisol than you do DHEA, this is when you're losing many different things that you can unpack, which again, you and I could talk about like from 9 to 5. I'll provide a couple of examples that I think the audience will find cool. One having to do with getting jacked, and the other having to do with being smart. Okay. Mm-hmm. So first off, cortisol is highly catabolic, whereas DHEA is highly anabolic. So what I've done a lot in my practice is utilize the cortisol to DHEA sulfate ratio to formulate my own catabolic to anabolic ratio of the body. And this is like this is basically where hard gainers live. Hard gainers, that's not a thing, that doesn't exist. People will be mad about me for that, but I don't care. I've made a lot of hard gainers jacked. And what happens in this case is it's not the calories that your body is taking in. It's the physiology that those calories are going into that's going to determine the anabolic potential of your diet. So like, let's say you have two biological twins. They are on the exact same training program and the exact same diet, okay? And they're twins, exact same genetics. But you give one of them steroids, who's going to get better results? The one on steroids. Mm-hmm. He's going to get better results 10 times out of 10. They're on the same diet and training program, but his physiology is different, okay? That matters. Mm-hmm. It's not the calories that are going into your body. It's the physiology that those calories are going into that is going to determine the anabolic potential of your diet. Okay, this is why cortisol is connected to cortisol to DHEA sulfate is connected to catabolism. It is also an overtraining marker. It is also a marker for immune function. This ratio is connected to all of these things that are highly either anabolic or catabolic, depending on what side of the equation you're on. So if you want to be jacked and you want to avoid overtraining, this is the ratio to actually be very in tune with and something to monitor probably quarterly.
But what else brings down DHEA other than cortisol?
Something that can bring down DHEA that I've found is if somebody actually uses hormone replacement therapy. So if somebody is on, say, testosterone, It's actually quite valuable for them to also be on DHEA, because DHEA is a precursor for testosterone. So if you are now having an exogenous source of testosterone, your body's the ultimate efficiency machine. It's not going to make as much of this previous precursor that it needed to formulate on its own, because you're already getting an exogenous source of this thing that it was used for already. So that's actually a big thing that I've seen push it down before, is exogenous hormone use and chronic stress. And if you combine those two things together, you have very low DHEA.
What an awesome mashup. I loved learning about these two things. And guys, if you are wondering, well, Louisa, where do I get blood work done? You can go to insidetracker.com/Louisa, put in your information. I definitely think you should get the ultimate package, because not only will you get all of the right blood biomarkers tested, but you'll also get the proper and performance-based reference ranges. Then you'll also get a whole bunch of recommendations based on supplementation and behavioral tools to help modify these biomarkers. InsideTracker.com/Louisa, enter code Louisa20 for 20% off.